This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents One Second After by William R. Forstchen. For my daughter, Megan Marie Forstchen, and for those who protect her, that she might grow up in peace, and for my father, John Joseph Forstchen, who taught me what should truly be valued in life. Foreword by Speaker Newt Gingrich. Though this book is a work of fiction, it is also a work of fact, perhaps a future history that should be thought-provoking, and yes, even terrifying for all of us. I know this from personal study across decades of the very real threat to American security that is posed by this particular weapon that Bill Forstchen writes about in One Second After. There has been much attention given since 9/11 to a wide variety of threats to our nation. Additional attacks by the hijacking of commercial airliners, biological and chemical attacks, even the potential of a so-called dirty bomb, or even an actual nuclear detonation in the center of one of our major cities. But few have talked about, let alone heard about, the terrible, in fact overwhelming threat of EMP, which is shorthand for electromagnetic pulse weapon. My friend, Captain William Sanders, USN, one of our nation's leading experts on this particular weapon, will provide the afterword for this book, explaining in greater detail using unclassified documents as to how such a weapon works. In short form here, when an atomic bomb is detonated above the Earth's atmosphere, it can generate a pulse wave, which travels at the speed of light and will short-circuit every electronic device that the wave touches on the Earth's surface. It is like a super lightning bolt striking next to your house and taking out your computer, except infinitely worse, for it will strike our entire nation, most likely without warning, and could destroy our entire complex electrical grid and everything attached into that grid. It is a real threat, a very real threat, and one that has deeply worried myself and many others for years. My friend, Bill Forstchen, has co-authored 6 historical novels with me across the years. I have gotten to know him closely. He holds a Ph.D. in history from Purdue. He has specialized in the history of military technology, and this is no wild flight of fantasy on his part. In fact, the start of this book was a conversation that Bill and I shared several years back, concluding with his announcing that he felt he should write a novel about the threat to raise public awareness. As I said before, I see this book as a terrifying future history that might come true. Such books have a significant tradition in their own right. H.G. Wells wrote frightfully accurate prophecies of what history now calls World Wars I and II. Two of the great classics of the Cold War, Alas Babylon and the movie Testament, gave us a profoundly moving glimpse of what would happen to ordinary citizens if war between us and the Soviets was ever unleashed. In fact, Bill will openly admit that those two classics were indeed models for this book. I also compare it to perhaps the most famous of the future history books of modern times, George Orwell's 1984. If the evil of totalitarian regimes had been allowed to flourish in the rubble of Europe after World War II, that future history might have come to pass. Orwell, by his book, raised an awareness that just might have saved us from Big Brother and the thought police. I'd like to think that Bill's novel may do the same. Few in our government and in the public sector have openly confronted the threat offered by the use of but one nuclear weapon in the hands of a determined enemy who calibrates it to trigger a massive EMP burst. Such an event would destroy our complex, delicate, high-tech society in an instant and throw all of our lives back to an existence equal to that of the Middle Ages. Millions would die in the first week alone, perhaps even you who are reading this, if you require certain medications, let alone the most basic needs of our lives, such as food and clean water. The place Bill writes about is real. He has set this story in his hometown and the college that he works at. I remember when he was writing the book and we'd talk. More than once, he was deeply disturbed by what he had researched, discovered, and was now trying to express as a story for all to read. What hit him the most, he told me, is that he kept picturing his teenage daughter in this nightmare reality, and I think as you read the book you will see that point of identification. It struck me deeply as well, for I have two grandchildren. As he wishes to protect his daughter from this fate, so do I wish to protect my grandchildren, to be able to pass on to them an America that is safe from such threats. The threat is real, and we as Americans must face that threat, prepare, and know what to do to prevent it. For if we do not, one second after, the America we know, cherish, and love will be gone forever. For I have become death, the destroyer of worlds. Chapter 1. Black Mountain, North Carolina, 2:30 EDT. John Matherson lifted the plastic bag off the counter. "You sure I have the right ones?" he asked. Nancy, the owner of the shop, Ivy Corner, smiled. "Don't worry, John. She already had them picked out weeks ago. Give her a big hug and kiss for me. Hard to believe she's 12 today." John sighed and nodded, looking down at the bag stuffed with a dozen Beanie Babies, one for each year of Jennifer's life, which started 12 years ago this day. "Hope she still wants these at 13, he said. "God save me when that first boy shows up at the door wanting to take her out." The two laughed, Nancy nodding in agreement. He was already enduring that with Elizabeth, his 16-year-old, and perhaps for that and so many other reasons as well, he just wished that he could preserve, could drag out just for a few more days, weeks, or months, the precious time all fathers remember fondly, when they still had their little girl. It was a beautiful spring day. The cherry trees lining the street in full bloom, a light shower of pink petals drifting on the wind as he walked up the street past Doc Keller's office, the antique stores, the new, rather gothic-looking art gallery that had opened last month, the usual curio shops, and even an old-style ice cream parlor at $1.50 a scoop. Next up the street was Benson's Used and Rare Books. John hesitated, wanted to go in just for a few minutes, then pulled out his cell phone to check the time. 2:30. Her bus would be rolling in at 3, no time today to go in, have a cup of coffee, and talk about books and history. Walt Benson saw him, held up a cup, gesturing for John to join him. He shook his head, pointing to his wrist, even though he never wore a watch, and continued to walk up to the corner to where his Talon SUV was parked in front of Taylor's Hardware and General Store. John paused and looked back down the street for a moment. "I'm living in a damn Norman Rockwell painting," he thought yet again, for the 1,000th time. "Winding up here." He never imagined it, never planned for it, or even wanted it. 8 years back, he was at the Army War College, Carlisle, PA, teaching military history and lecturing on asymmetrical warfare and waiting to jump the hoop and finally get his first star. And then two things happened. His promotion came through, with assignment to Brussels as a liaison to NATO, a rather nice posting to most likely end out his career. And then Mary had returned from the doctor's several days after the promotion, her face pale, lips pressed tight, and said 4 words. "I have breast cancer." The commandant at Carlisle, Bob Scales, an old friend who had stood as godfather for John's Jennifer, understood the request he then laid before him. John would take the promotion, but could it be to the Pentagon? It had placed them nearby to Johns Hopkins and not too far from Mary's family. It didn't work. Cutbacks were hitting as it was. Oh, there was great sympathy from upstairs, but he had to take Brussels if he wanted the star, and maybe a year later they'd find a slot for him stateside. After talking to Mary's doctor, John resigned. He would take her back home to Black Mountain, North Carolina, which was what she wanted, and the cancer treatment center at Chapel Hill would be nearby. Bob's connections were good, remarkably good, when John first mentioned Black Mountain. A single phone call was made. The Old Boy Network, though disdained as politically incorrect, did exist, and it did help at times when needed. The president of Montreat College, North Carolina, in Mary's hometown, did indeed suddenly need an assistant director of development. John hated development and admissions work, but survived it until finally a tenure-track professorship in history opened 4 years back and he was slotted in. The fact that the president of the college, Dan Hunt, owed his life to Bob Scales, who had dragged him out of a minefield back in 1970, was a definite mark in John's favor that could not be ignored between friends. Dan had lost his leg. Bob got another of his bronze stars for saving him, and the two had been buddies ever since, each looking out as well for those whom the other cared for. So Mary got to go home. After 20 years of following John from Benning to Germany to Okinawa, sweating out Desert Storm, from there to the Pentagon, then a year, a wonderful year, at West Point, and then 3 more wonderful years teaching at Carlisle. At heart, he was a history teacher, and maybe whichever bastard in the personnel office at the Pentagon had nixed John's request to stay stateside had done him a favor. So they came home to Black Mountain, North Carolina. He did not hesitate 1 second in granting her wish, resigning his commission and promotion and moving to this corner of the Carolina Mountains. He looked back down Main Street, frozen for a moment in time and memories. Mary would be gone 4 years next week. Her last time out, a slow, exhausting walk down this street, which as a girl she had run along. It was indeed a Norman Rockwell town. That final walk down this street with her, everyone knew what was happening, and everyone came out to say hi, to give her a hug, a kiss, all knowing it was farewell, but not saying it. It was a gesture of love John would never forget. He pushed the thought aside. It was still too close, and Jennifer's bus would be pulling up in 20 minutes. He got into his Talon, started it up, turned onto State Street, and headed east. He did love the view as State Street curved through town, past yet more shops, nearly all the buildings red brick, dating back to the turn of the century. The village had once been a thriving community, part of the tuberculosis sanitarium business. When the railroad had finally pierced the mountains of western North Carolina in the early 1880s, some of the first to flood in were tuberculosis victims. They came by the thousands, to the sanitariums that sprang up on every sunlit mountain slope. By the early 20s, there were a dozen such institutions surrounding Asheville, the big city situated a dozen miles to the west of Black Mountain. And then came the Depression. Black Mountain remained frozen in time. And then came antibiotics right after the war, and the sanitariums emptied out. And all those wonderful buildings, which in other towns would have given way to shopping plazas and strip malls, had remained intact, progress passing Black Mountain by. Now there were conference centers for various churches and summer camps for kids, where the sanitariums had been. His own college had been founded at such a site up in what everyone called the Cove. A small college, 600 kids, most of them from small towns across the Carolinas and a few from Atlanta or Florida. Some of the kids were freaked out by the relative isolation, but most of them grudgingly admitted they loved it. A beautiful campus, a safe place, an old logging trail across the edge of the campus leading straight on up to Mount Mitchell. Good white water nearby for kayaking, and plenty of woods to disappear into for partying for some of them, to get around the fairly strict campus rules. The town itself finally revived, starting in the 1980s, but wonderfully the charming turn-of-the-century look was maintained, and in the summer and fall the streets would be crammed with tourists and day-trippers coming up from Charlotte or Winston-Salem, to escape the boiling heat of the lowlands, joined by hundreds of summer cottagers who lived in the Cove, many of the cottages darn near mansions for some of the older wealth of the South. That had been Mary's family, Old South, and wealth. Mima Jenny, Mary's mother and Jennifer's namesake, still hung on doggedly to their home up in the cove, refusing to consider moving, even though Papa Tyler was now in a nearby nursing home in the final stages of cancer. John continued to drive east, the traffic on Interstate 40 coming up through the Swannanoa Gap roaring by on his left. The old-timers in the town still expressed their hatred of that darn road. Before it came in, Black Mountain was a sleepy southern mountain hamlet. With the road had come development, traffic, and the floods of tourists on weekends that the Chamber of Commerce loved and everyone else tried to tolerate. Staying on the old highway that paralleled the interstate, John drove for less than a mile out of town, then turned right onto a dirt road that twisted up the side of a hill overlooking the town. The old mountain joke used to be, "You know you're getting directions to a mountain home when they say, 'Turn onto the dirt road.'" For a kid from New Jersey, John still got a bit of a kick out of the fact that he did indeed live in the South, on the side of a mountain, halfway up a dirt road with a view worth $1 million. The home he and Mary had purchased was in one of the first new developments in the area. In a county where there was no zoning, the lower part of the hill had several trailers, an old shack where Connie Yarborough, a wonderful down-the-hill neighbor, still did not have electricity or town water, and next to her was an eccentric Volkswagen repair shop, the owner, Jim Bartlett, a true 60s throwback. His lot littered with dozens of rusting Beetles, vans, and even a few precious VW buses and Carmen Ghias. The house, Mary and John actually named Rivendell because of their mutual love of Tolkien, offered a broad sweeping view of the valley below. The skyline of Asheville was in the distance, framed by the great Smoky Mountains beyond, facing due west so Mary could have her sunsets. When trying to describe the view, he'd just tell friends, "Check out Last of the Mohicans. It was filmed a half hour from where we live." It was a fairly contemporary-looking type of home, high ceiling, the west wall from bedroom across the living room to the dining area, all glass. The bed was still positioned to face the glass wall, as Mary wanted it, so she could watch the outside world as her life drifted away. He pulled up the drive. The two idiots, Ginger and Zack, both golden retrievers, both beautiful-looking dogs, and both thicker than bricks when it came to brains, had been out sunning on the bedroom deck. They stood up and barked madly as if he were an invader, though if he were a real invader, they'd have cowered in terror and stained the carpet as they fled into Jennifer's room to hide. The two idiots charged through the bedroom, then out through the entryway screen door, the lower half of the door a charade as the screen was gone. Put a new one in, it'd last a few days, and the idiots would charge right through it again. John had given up on that fight years ago. As for actually closing the door, it never even crossed his mind anymore. This was Black Mountain. Strange as it seemed, folks rarely locked up. Keys would be left in cars. Kids did indeed play in the streets in the evening. There were parades for the 4th of July, Christmas, and the ridiculous Pinecone Festival, complete to the crowning of a Miss Pinecone. Papa Tyler had absolutely humiliated his daughter, Mary, in front of John early on in their courtship when he proudly pulled out a photo of her, Miss Pinecone 1977. In Black Mountain, there was still an ice cream truck that made the rounds on summer nights. It was all one hell of a difference from his boyhood just outside of Newark, New Jersey. There was a car parked at the top of the driveway. Mary's mother, Mima Jenny. Mima Jenny was behind the wheel of her wonderful and highly eccentric 1959 Ford Edsel. Ford. That's where the family money had come from. Ownership of a string of car dealerships across the Carolinas dating back to Henry Ford himself. There was even a photo framed in the house up in the cove of Mary's great-granddad and Henry Ford at the opening of a dealership in Charlotte back before World War I. Though it wasn't polite to be overtly business in their strata, and Jenny preferred the role of genteel Southern lady, in her day, John knew, she was one shrewd business person, as was her husband. John pulled up alongside the Edsel. Jenny put down the book she was reading and got out. "Hi, Jen." She absolutely hated Ma, Mother, Mom, or mortal sin of all mortal sins, Mima, or Grandma, from her Yankee son-in-law, who was definitely not her first choice for her only daughter. But that had softened with time, especially towards the end, especially when he had brought the girls back home to Jen. The two got out of their cars, and she held up a cheek to be kissed. Her height, at little more than 5'2", overshadowed by his 6'4" bulk, and there was a light touch of her hand on his arm, and an affectionate squeeze. "Thought you'd never get here in time. She'll be home any minute." Jen had yet to slip into the higher pitch or gravelly tone of an old lady's voice. He wondered if she practiced every night, reciting before a mirror to keep that wonderful young woman-sounding Southern lilt. It was an accent that still haunted him, the same as Mary's when they had first met at Duke 28 years ago. At times, if Jen was in the next room and called to the girls, it would still bring tears to his eyes. "We got time. Why didn't you go inside to wait?"
"With those two mongrels, the way they jump, they'd ruin my nylons."
Ginger and Zack were all over John, jumping, barking, leaping about, and studiously avoiding Jen. Though dumb, Goldens knew when someone didn't like them, no matter how charming they might be. John reached in, pulled out the bag of beanies, and, walking over to the stone wall that bordered the path to the house, began to line them up, one at a time, setting them side by side.
"Now, John, really, isn't she getting a bit old for that?"
"Not yet. Not my little girl." Jen laughed softly.
"You can't keep time back forever."
"I can try, can't I?" he said with a grin. She smiled sadly.
"How do you think Tyler and I felt about you the day you came through our door?"
He reached out and gave her an affectionate touch on the cheek. "You guys loved me."
"You a Yankee? Like hell. Tyler actually thought about driving you off with a shotgun. And that first night you stayed over."
Even after all these years, he found he still blushed a bit at that. Jen had caught Mary and him in a less-than-proper situation on the family room sofa at 2 in the morning. Though not fully improper, it was embarrassing nevertheless, and Jen had never let him live it down. He set the beanies out, stepped back, eyeballed them like a sergeant examining a row of new recruits. The red, white, and blue patriot there on the right should be in the middle of the ranks where a flag-bearer might be. He could hear the growl of the school bus as it shifted gears, turning off of old Route 70, coming up the hill.
"Here she comes," Jen announced excitedly.
Going back to the Edsel, she leaned in the open window and brought out a flat, elegantly wrapped box, tied off with a neat bow.
"Jewelry?" John asked. "Of course. She's 12 now. A proper young lady should have a gold necklace at 12. Her mother did."
"Yeah, I remember that necklace," he said with a grin. "She was wearing it that night you just mentioned, and she was 20 then."
"You cad,"
Jen said softly and slapped him lightly on the shoulder, and he pretended that it was a painful blow. Ginger and Zack had stopped jumping around John, both of them cocking their heads, taking in the sound of the approaching school bus, the squeal of the brakes as it stopped at the bottom of the driveway, its yellow barely visible now through the spring-blooming trees. They were both off like lightning bolts, running full tilt down the driveway, barking up a storm, and seconds later he could hear the laughter of Jennifer, of Patricia, a year older and their neighbor, and of Seth, Pat's 11th-grade brother. The girls came running up the driveway. Seth threw a stick, the two dogs diverted by it for a moment, but then turned together and charged up the hill behind the girls. Seth waved, then crossed the street to his house. John felt a hand slip into his. Jen's.
"Just like her mother,"
Jen whispered, voice choked.
Yes, he could see Mary and Jennifer, slender,
actually skinny as a rail, shoulder-length blonde hair tied back, still a lanky little girl. She slowed a bit, reaching out to put a hand on a tree as if to brace herself. Patricia turned and waited for her. John felt a momentary concern, wanted to go down to her, but knew better. Jen actually held him back.
"You are too protective," Jen whispered. "She must handle it on her own."
Young Jennifer caught her breath, looked up, a bit pale, saw them waiting, and a radiant smile lit her face.
"Mima! And you drove the Edsel today. Can we go for a ride?"
Jen let her hand slip, bent over slightly as Jennifer ran up to her grandmother, the two embracing.
"How's my birthday, girl?"
They hugged, and Grandma Jen showered Jennifer with kisses, 12 of them, counting each off. Pat looked over at the beanies lined up, smiled, and looked up at John.
"Afternoon, Mr. Matheson."
"How are you, Pat?"
"I think she needs to be checked," Pat whispered.
"It can wait."
"Daddy!"
Jennifer was now in his arms. He lifted her up, hugged her with fierce intensity, so that she laughed, then groaned.
"You'll break my back!"
He let go of her, watching her eyes as she looked past him to the beanie babies lining the wall. And yes, there was still that childlike glow in them.
"Patriot Bear and Ollie Ostrich!"
As she started to sweep them up, he looked over at Jen with a bit of a triumphant smile, as if to say, "See, she's still my little girl." Jen, rising to the challenge, came up to Jennifer's side and held out the flat box.
"Happy birthday, darling."
Jennifer tore the paper off. Ginger, thinking the paper was now a gift to her, half-swallowed it and ran off as Zack chased her. When Jennifer opened the box, her eyes widened.
"Oh, Mima, it's time my girl had a real gold necklace. Maybe your friend can help you put it on."
John looked down at the gift. My God, it must have cost a fortune. Heavy, almost pencil thick. Jen looked at him out of the corner of her eye as if to meet any challenge.
"You're a young lady now,"
Jen announced as Pat helped to clasp the necklace on, and then Jen produced a small mirror from her purse and held it up.
"Oh, Grandma, it's lovely.
A lovely gift for a lovely lady."
John stood silent for a moment, not sure what to say as his little girl gazed into the mirror, raising her head slightly the way a woman would, to admire the gold.
"Sweetie, I think you better check your blood sugar. You seemed a bit winded coming up the hill,"
John finally said, and his words came out heavily, breaking the moment.
"Yes, Daddy."
Jennifer leaned against the wall, took off her backpack, and pulled out the blood sugar test monitor. It was one of the new digital readout models. No more finger pricking, just a quick jab to the arm. She absently fingered the necklace with her free hand while waiting for the readout. 142. A bit high.
"I think you better get some insulin into you," John said. She nodded.
Jennifer had lived with it for 10 years now. He knew that was a major part of his protectiveness of her. When she was in her terrible twos and threes, it tore his heart out every time he had to prick her finger. The sight of his or Mary's approach with the test kit set off howls of protest. The doctors had all said that as quickly as possible, Jennifer had to learn to monitor herself, that John and Mary needed to step back, even when she was only 7 and 8, to let her know her own signs, test, and medicate. Mary had handled it far better than John had, perhaps because of her own illness towards the end. Jen, with her strength, had the same attitude.
"Strange. Here I am, a soldier of 20 years. Saw some action, but the only casualties were the Iraqis, never my own men. I was trained to handle things, but when it came to my daughter's diabetes, a damn aggressive type 1, I was always on edge. Tough, damn good at what I did, well respected by my men, and yet complete jelly when it comes to my girls." "There's a few more gifts inside," John said. "Why don't you girls go on in? Once your sister gets home and your friends show up, we can have our party."
Oh, Dad, didn't you get Elizabeth's message?
What message?
Here, silly.
She reached up and fished the cell phone out of his breast pocket, tucked in behind a pack of cigarettes. She started to pull the cigarettes out, to stomp on them or tear them up, but a look from him warned her off.
"Someday, Daddy,"
she sighed. Then, taking the phone, she punched a few keys and handed it back. "Home late, out with Ben," the screen said.
"She texted you and me during lunch."
"Texted?"
"Yes, Daddy. Text message. All the kids are doing it now."
"What's wrong with a phone call?" She looked at him as if he were from the antediluvian period, and then headed inside.
"Texted?"
Jen asked. John held the phone so she could read the message. Jen smiled.
"Better start keeping a sharper watch on Elizabeth," she said. "If that Ben Johnson has any of his grandfather's blood in him."
She chuckled as if remembering something from long ago. "I don't need to hear this."
"No, you don't, Colonel."
"Actually, I kind of prefer doctor or professor."
"A doctor is someone who sticks things in you. A professor, well, they always struck me as a bit strange. Either rakes chasing the girls or boring, dusty types. Down here in the South, Colonel sounds best. More masculine."
"Well, I am no longer in active service. I am a professor, so let's just settle for John." Jen gazed up at him for a moment, then came up to his side, stood on tiptoes, and kissed his cheek lightly.
"I can see why my own little girl once fell for you, John. You'll lose both of them soon enough to some pimply-faced boys, so do hang on to her as long as you can."
"Well, you sure as hell didn't help draping that gold necklace on her. What did it cost, $1,000, $1,500?
"Roughly. But then again, no lady tells the truth when it comes to her buying jewelry."
"Until the bill comes in and the husband has to pay." There was a pause. He knew he had misspoken. If he had said such a thing around Mary, she'd have lit into him about a woman being independent and the hell with a husband handling the bills. And in fact, she did handle all the family finances right up till the last weeks of her life. As for Tyler, though, he no longer even knew what a bill was, and that hurt, no matter how self-reliant Jen tried to appear to be.
"I best be going," Jen said.
"Sorry, I didn't mean it that way."
"It's all right, John. Let me go up to the nursing home to spend some time with Tyler, and I'll be back for the party."
"Jennifer was expecting a ride in that monstrous car of yours."
"The Edsel, my dear young man, was a generation ahead of its time."
"And the biggest flop in the history of Ford Motors. My God, look at that grill. It's ugly as sin." She lightened up a bit with the banter. There were half a dozen cars in her huge garage, several newer ones, but also an actual Model A up on blocks, and beauty of beauties, a powder-blue 1965 Mustang convertible. A lot of bad memories, though, were tied to that Mustang. When John and Mary were dating, they had conned her parents into letting them borrow the car for a cruise up the Blue Ridge Parkway to Mount Mitchell, and John, driving it, had rear-ended an elderly couple's Winnebago. No one was hurt, but the car was totaled, and Tyler had poured thousands into getting it restored, and swore that no one other than him or Jen would ever drive it again. And Jen still lived by that ruling.
"This Edsel will run forever, my dear, and just check on eBay to see how much it's worth. I bet a heck of a lot more than that SUV thing you've got."
He settled back against the stone wall as Jen maneuvered the monster around and cruised down the driveway at breakneck speed. The wall was warm from the afternoon sun. The beanies were still there, and oh, that did hurt a bit. At least she could have carried Patriot Bear or the ostrich in. Inside, he could hear Jennifer and Pat chatting away about the necklace until the stereo kicked on. Some strange female wailing sounds. Britney Spears? No, she was old stuff now, thank God. What it was, he couldn't tell, other than the fact that he didn't like it.
Pink Floyd, some of the old stuff his parents listened to, like Sinatra or Glenn Miller, or, better yet, the Chieftains, were more his speed. He picked up one of the beanies, Patriot Bear.
"Well, my friend, guess we'll soon be left behind," he said.
Leaning against the wall, he soaked in the view, the tranquility of the moment, broken only by the distant rumble of traffic on I-40 and the noise inside the house. Ginger and Zack came back from their romp in the field behind the house and flopped down at his feet, panting hard. The scent of lilacs was heavy on the air. If anyone wanted to truly see spring, they should live in these mountains. Down in the valley below, the cherry trees were in full bloom. Just several hundred feet higher, here at his home, they were just beginning to blossom, but the lilacs were already blooming. To his right, 10 miles away, the top of Mount Mitchell was actually crowned with a touch of snow. Winter was still up there. When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed. The scent always triggered in his mind Whitman's lament for Lincoln. It reminded John that tonight, the second Tuesday of the month, was Civil War Roundtable night in the basement of the Methodist Church. It'd be another fun round of the usual raucous debate, the other members all needling him as their one and only Yankee, whom they could pick on. And then the phone rang. He pulled it out of his pocket, expecting it to be Elizabeth. There was going to be hell to pay if it was. How she could stand up her kid sister on her birthday to sneak off with that pimple-faced, horny, fast-handed Johnson kid. But the area code was 703, and John recognized the next three numbers, the Pentagon. He opened the phone and clicked it on.
"Hey, Bob. John, how you doing?"
"Where's my goddaughter?"
He said it doing a halfway decent imitation of Marlon Brando as Don Corleone. Bob Scales, now 3 stars, John's former boss at Carlisle and a damn good friend, had stood as Jennifer's godfather, and though Irish Catholic rather than Italian, he took the job seriously. He and his wife Barbara usually came down 3 or 4 times a year. When Mary died, they had taken a couple of weeks off and stayed to help. They never had children, and thus they considered Jennifer and Elizabeth to be their surrogates. "Growing up," John said sadly, "her grandmother gave her a gold necklace that must have cost $1,000 or more, which counted a hell of a lot more than the beanies and the stack of Pokemon cards still waiting inside. I even got tickets to Disney World for once school lets out that I'll give her at dinner, but I wonder now if it will be the same."
"You mean when you took her there when she was 6 and Elizabeth 10? "Hell yeah, it will be different, but you'll still see the little girl come out down there, even with Elizabeth. How's Elizabeth doing, by the way?"
"I'm thinking of shooting her boyfriend later today." Bob roared with laughter.
"Maybe it's best I didn't have daughters," Bob finally replied. "Sons, yeah." His voice trailed off for a moment. "Hey, let me speak to Jennifer, okay?"
"Sure."
John walked into the house, shouting for Jennifer, who came dashing out of her bedroom, still wearing that damn necklace, and grabbed the phone.
"Hi, Uncle Bob."
John tapped her on the shoulder. "You take your insulin?" he asked. She nodded her head. Then, chattering away, she walked around the house. John looked out the window across the valley to the mountains beyond. It was a beautiful, pristine spring day, and his mood began to lighten. Several of Jennifer's friends would be over soon for a small party. He'd cook up some burgers on the grill out on the side deck. The kids would then retreat to Jennifer's room. He had just opened the pool in the backyard over the weekend, and though the water was a chilly 68, a couple of the kids might jump in. He'd flush them out around dark, go to his round table meeting, and maybe later this evening he'd dig back into that article he was committed to for the Civil War Journal about Lee versus Grant as a strategic commander. A no-brainer, but still an extra $500 when done, and another Vita builder for tenure review next year. He could stay up late. His first lecture wasn't until 11 in the morning tomorrow.
"Dad? Uncle Bob wants you."
Jennifer came out of her bedroom, holding up the phone. John took it,
gave her a quick peck on the top of her head and a playful swat as she ran back off. Seconds later, the damn stereo in her room doubled in sound.
"Yeah, Bob?"
"John, I gotta run." He could sense some tension in Bob's voice. He could hear some voices in the background, shouting. It was hard to tell, though. Jennifer's stereo was blaring.
"Sure, Bob. Will you be down next month?"
"Look, John, something's up. Got a problem here. I gotta..." The phone went dead. At that same instant, the ceiling fan began to slowly wind down. The stereo in Jennifer's room shut down, and looking over to his side alcove office, he saw the computer screensaver disappear, the green light of the on button on the 19-inch monitor disappearing. There was a chirping beep, the signal that the home security and fire alarm system was offline. Then that went silent as well.
"Bob?"
Silence on the other end. John snapped the phone shut. Damn, power failure.
"Dad?"
It was Jennifer.
"My CD player died."
"Yeah, honey."
"Thank God," he thought silently.
"Power failure."
She looked at him a bit crestfallen, as if he were somehow responsible or could snap his finger to make the CD player come back on. Actually, if he could permanently arrange for that damn player to die, he would be tempted to do it.
"What about my party? Pat just gave me a CD and I wanted to play it."
"No worries, sweetie. Let me call the power company. Most likely a blown transformer."
He picked up the landline phone. Silence. No dial tone. Last time that happened, some drunk had rammed into a telephone pole down at the bottom of the hill and wiped everything out. The drunk, of course, had walked away from it. Cell phone. John opened it back up, started to punch numbers. Nothing. Damn. Cell phone was dead. He put it down on the kitchen table. Puzzling. The battery in his phone must have gone out just as Bob clicked off. Hell, without electricity, John couldn't charge it back up to call the power company. He looked over at Jennifer, who stared at him expectantly, as if he would now resolve things.
"No problem at all, kid. They'll be on it, and besides, it's a beautiful day. You don't need to be listening to that garbage anyhow. Why can't you like Mozart or Debussy the way Pat here does?"
Pat looked at him uncomfortably, and he realized he had committed one of the mortal sins of parenting. Never compare your daughter to one of her buddies. "Go on outside. Give the dogs a run. They'll have the power back by dinner time."
Chapter 2 Day 1, 6 p.m. Flipping the four burgers on the grill, two for himself, one each for Jennifer and Pat, he looked over his shoulder and watched as the girls played tag with the dogs in the upper field behind his house. It was a beautiful sight. Late afternoon sun, the 8 apple trees in full blossom, the girls laughing as they dodged back and forth. Ginger, the younger and crazier of the two Goldens, knocked Jennifer over with a flying leap as she tried to hold a frisbee out of her reach, and there were more squeals as the two dogs and two girls piled on each other. Months ago, he had stopped wearing a wristwatch. The cell phone was now his timepiece. He looked through the kitchen window to the grandfather clock. It was just about 6. The other kids should have been here by now. The agreement was they could come over for a brief party, but as it was a school night, the party would be over by 7:30. No one had shown yet. For that matter, he thought Jen would have been back long ago. He lit a cigarette, puffing quickly. It was amazing how annoying a 12-year-old could be when it came to a quit-smoking dad campaign, and tossed the half-smoked Camel over the patio railing. Burgers done, he set them on the patio table, went in, opened the fridge, pulled out the cake, and set it on the table, sticking 12 candles in. Back out again to the deck.
"Dinner!"
The dogs responded long before the girls, racing out of the field, circled the table, and then sat at their usual begging positions. Pat and Jennifer came out of the field.
"Hey, Dad, something strange."
"Yeah?"
"Listen."
He stood there silent for a moment. It was a quiet spring evening, silent, except for a few birds chirping, the distant bark of a dog. Rather nice, actually.
I don't hear anything.
That's it, Dad. There's no traffic noise from the interstate.
He turned and faced towards the road. It was concealed by the trees, but she was right. There was absolute silence. When he had first purchased the house, that had been one disappointment he had not thought of while inspecting it, but was aware of the first night in, the rumble of traffic from the interstate a half mile away. The only time it fell silent was in the winter during a snowstorm or an accident.
An accident must have shut it down, he replied.
It was common enough, the long winding climb up from Old Fort. Every month or two a truck would lose its brakes and roll, or old folks in a 40-foot-long land yacht would lose it on the twisting turns as the highway zigzagged out of the mountains and down to the Piedmont. One such accident, a hazmat spill with a truck rolling over, had shut down traffic in both directions for over a day.
"Mr. Matheson, that's what we thought, but it's weird down there. No traffic jam, just cars stopped all over the place. You can see it from atop the hill."
"What do you mean?"
"Just that, Daddy. A bunch of cars, a lot on the side of the road, some in the middle, but no jam-up. Just everyone stopped."
He half-listened, while shoveling the burgers onto buns and putting them on the girls' plates.
"Most likely the accident's further on, and people were told to pull over and wait," he said.
The girls nodded and dug in. He ate his first burger in silence, saying nothing, just listening. It was almost eerie.
"You figure you'd hear something, a police siren if there was indeed an accident. Cars down on old Highway 70 should still be passing by."
Usually, if the interstate was closed, emergency vehicles would use 70 to access the highway, and it would be jammed with people trying to bypass the interstate. At the very least, this was the time of night the darn Jefferson kids up at the top of the hill would start tearing around into the forest with their damn four-wheelers. And then he looked up. He felt a bit of a chill. This time of day, any high-flying jets would be pulling contrails, and directly overhead was an approach corridor to Atlanta for most flights coming out of the Northeast. At any given time, there'd be two or three planes visible. Now the sky was sparkling blue, not a trace of a contrail. The chill. It reminded him of 9/11. How quiet it was that afternoon, everyone home watching their televisions, and the sky overhead empty of planes. He stood up, walked to the edge of the railing, shaded his eyes against the late afternoon sun. Up towards Craggy Dome there was a fire burning, smoke rising vertically, half a dozen acres from the look of it. Another fire raged much farther out on the distant ridge of the Smokies. In the village of Black Mountain nothing seemed to be moving. Usually, before the trees filled in completely, he could see the red and green of the traffic light at the intersection of State and Main. It was off, not even blinking. He looked back at the grandfather clock. It was usually this time of day that the million-dollar train came through, so named because it hauled over $1 million worth of coal, mined out of Kentucky for the power plants down near Charlotte. When the girls were younger, an after-dinner ritual was to drive down to the tracks and wave to the engineer as the five heavy diesel-electric locomotives, thundering with power, pulled their load and crawled towards the Swannanoa Gap Tunnel. The silence was interrupted by a throaty growl as Grandma Jen came up the driveway in her monster, the Edsel. She pulled in beside his Talon, got out, and walked up.
"Damnedest thing," she announced. "Power's out up at the nursing home, and you should see the interstate. Cars just sitting all over the place, not moving."
"The power at the nursing home?" John asked. "What about the backup generator? That's supposed to automatically kick in."
"Well, the lights went out in the nursing home. I mean completely out."
"They're supposed to have emergency generation. That's required," John said.
"Never kicked on.
Someone said there must be a broken relay, and they'd get an electrician in. But still, it's a worry. They had to shift patients on oxygen to bottled air, since the pumps in each room shut off. Tyler's feeding tube pump shut off as well.
Is he all right?
He was nearly done with the feeding anyhow, so no bother. They said he'd be okay. So I go out to the parking lot, and all the 5 o'clock shift of nurses and staff were out there, all of them turning keys, and nothing starting. But that old baby, the one you call the monster, just purred to life. Had to be here for my little girl, and that monster, as you call it, worked, as it always has.
She nodded back proudly to her Edsel.
"Can we go for a ride and see everything, Grandma?"
Jennifer asked. "What about your party?" John asked.
"No one else showed up,"
Jennifer said sadly. Grandma Jen leaned over and kissed her on the top of the head.
"Lord's sake, child, you're a mess."
They were up playing in the field.
"And wearing your necklace when doing that?"
Jen asked, horrified. John grimaced and realized he should have made sure Jennifer had taken it off before running around with the dogs. If she had lost it or it got broken in the roughhousing with the dogs, there'd have been hell to pay. "A burger, Jen?" he asked quickly to distract her. She shook her head.
"Not hungry."
"At least some cake."
"Okay."
He went back into the kitchen and lit the 12 candles on the cake, a special one, of course, no sugar, and brought it out singing Happy Birthday, Pat and Jen joining in. The other gifts were now opened. A card from Bob and Barbara Scales with a gift certificate for $100 for Amazon. The beanies he had carried over from the wall and lined up on the table. Jennifer tucked Patriot Bear under her arm and opened the huge envelope, half as big as herself, that John had made up the night before. A collage of photos of Disney World with a fake Ticket for Jennifer, Daddy, and, oh yeah, Elizabeth, printed in the middle. It was indeed a hit, and now it was his turn to say, "Hey, don't squeeze so hard, you'll break my neck." Finally it was over, past 7, and Pat started down the hill. Jennifer and the dogs walked her home. "Guess there's no round table meeting tonight," John said, looking back towards town, as Jen helped him load up the dishwasher, even though they couldn't turn it on.
"What do you think is going on?"
Jen asked, and he could hear a touch of nervousness in her voice. "What do you mean?"
"John, it kind of reminds me of 9/11, the silence. But we still had electricity then. We could see the news. All those cars stalled."
He didn't say anything. There was a thought, but it was too disturbing to contemplate right now. He wanted to believe that it was just a weird combination of coincidences, a power failure that might be regional and would ground most flights due to air traffic control. Maybe it was some sort of severe solar storm, potent enough to trigger a massive short circuit. A similar event had happened up in Canada several years ago. A thought hit him. "Your monster. Let's go turn it on."
"Why?"
"You'll see." They went out to the car. John slid into the passenger seat, and she turned the key over, and the car instantly roared to life. The sound, even after but a couple of hours of silence, was reassuring. He turned on the radio. It really was one of the old ones, with dials to turn, no buttons to push. The slightly yellowed face even had the two small triangles on them, marking the frequency of the old civil defense broadcast frequencies. Static. Nothing but static, from one end of the dial to the other. It was getting towards twilight, usually the time the FCC had most AM stations powered down, but the big ones, the ones with enough bucks to pay for the license, should be powering up now to 50,000 watts, and reaching halfway across the country if the atmospherics were right. He could remember as a kid making the long drive from Jersey down to Duke in his old battered 1969 Bug, killing the time by slowly turning the dial, picking up WGN in Chicago, that strange country and western station out of Wheeling, so alien-sounding with its laments about pickup trucks and women, and throughout the night, if the atmospherics were just right,
W.O.R. of New York, catching his favorite, Gene Shepherd, in the middle of the night. Now it was just silence.
"You look worried, Colonel."
He looked over at her. The way she said Colonel. Could be nothing. Might be one hell of a solar storm, that's all. That seemed to scare her, and she looked to the western horizon, where the sun was now low, hanging over the Smokies.
"It isn't blowing up or something, is it?"
He laughed. "My dear mother-in-law, if it had blown up, would we still be seeing it?" A bit embarrassed, she shook her head. "Major storm on the sun's surface will send out heavy bursts of various radiations. That's what triggers the northern lights."
"Never seen them."
"Well, you're not a Yankee, that's why. Sometimes the storm is so intense it sets off an electrical discharge in the atmosphere that short-circuits electronic equipment."
"But the cars?"
"Most cars today are loaded with computers. It might explain why yours keeps running and others stopped."
"People should have kept those old Fords,"
she said with a nervous smile. "Let's do this, though," he said quietly. "I'm worried about Elizabeth. Let's drive downtown, see if we can spot her."
"Fine with me."
She shifted the car into gear. At the bottom of the driveway, he caught sight of Jennifer, shouted for her to pile in, and she ran over, delighted, climbing over her father and sitting between the two of them. That's the way it used to be 40 years ago, he realized. Mom and Dad out for a drive, the kid between them. No bucket seats yet, except in sports cars. Junior, not locked up in the back, and, of course, belted in. John just hoped Tom Barker, the town's chief of police, didn't spot them. Although John was now a well-confirmed local, Barker might just lay a ticket on them, if in a foul mood. They arrived to the bottom of the hill, and Old 70 was empty, except for a couple of abandoned cars by the side of the road. But out on the interstate, there was indeed a bunch of cars, as Jennifer had described it. Vehicles on the shoulders, some stalled right in the lanes. Not a traffic jam, though, just as if everyone had shut their engines off at the same time and drifted to a stop. Nearly all the passengers were out, some looking over towards them as the Edsel pulled out onto 70 and headed towards town, driving parallel to the interstate.
"There's Elizabeth!"
Jennifer cried, pointing down the road. Sure enough, it was her, walking with that damn Johnson kid, his arm around her waist. Not actually her waist, but down lower, nearly resting on her backside. At the sight of the approaching Edsel, Ben quickly jerked his hand away. Jen pulled over to the side of the road, and John got out. "Where in hell have you two been?" John shouted.
"Hey, Dad, isn't this weird?"
Elizabeth said with a smile, pointing towards the interstate. She already had on her best con artist smile. Her head was tilted slightly, a bit of an, "Ah, Daddy, chill out," look in her blue eyes, playing every angle. She was, of course, a 16-year-old spitting image of her mother, and she knew that would melt him. At this moment it also was triggering one hell of a protective surge. He turned his gaze on Ben. The boy had been a member of the scout troop that John had helped out as an assistant scoutmaster for several years. From that angle, Ben was a good kid, smart, made it to life before dropping out because by ninth grade scouting wasn't cool anymore. A nice kid, his dad a member of the round table. But at this moment, Ben was a young man who had damn near been resting his hand on John's daughter's butt, and Lord knows where else over the last 4 hours.
"Mr. Matheson, it's my fault, sir," Ben said, stepping forward slightly. "Elizabeth and I went into the mall in Asheville after school. We wanted to get something special for Jennifer."
"What do you get me?"
Jennifer asked excitedly.
"We left it in the car,"
Elizabeth replied.
"Dad, it was weird. The car just died a couple of miles west of town, near our church. It was weird, so we've been walking home."
John glared coldly at Ben, and the boy returned his gaze, not lowering his eyes. The kid was okay, John realized. Didn't lower his gaze or try to act like a wise ass. He knew he had been seen and was willing to face an angry father. Elizabeth and Ben had been friends when in middle school. Both were in the band together. And now, well, now, it was obvious over the last several months he had turned into something different. It was just that as John gazed at